We're talking about opioid issues, the opioid epidemic, the crisis, and the effects of the Center for Disease Control's supposedly voluntary guidelines enacted in 2016, now in effect in law across the country. What are pain patients supposed to do? Some of them have taken their own lives. Many are living in agony. Many are fearful of what the future holds. We have a link on the website where the FDA is creating something called an Opioid Policy Steering Committee. They're inviting public input. So if you're concerned about what the future holds, you might want to log in there and share your comments and opinions with the FDA as they put together opioid policy for the future, because it certainly can't be much worse than what the CDC has done. In a moment, we're going to get into the effects on chronic pain patients across the country with my next guest, Richard Red Lawhorn, a PhD, a writer, research analyst, patient advocate, website moderator for chronic pain patients, families, and physicians. His wife and daughter are chronic pain patients. He spent 21 years writing about these issues, and he's my guest when we come back. Moment ago, Richard Red Lawhorn has been dealing with chronic pain issues in his family for more than 20 years. He's helped co-found ATIP, Alliance for the Treatment of Intractable Pain. Red, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning.
Is there a reason for hope? I mean, is there, I don't know if you heard the earlier segments, but Dr. Ziegler had felt that there might be room for improvement here. Is there hope in your household?
Well, there's hope. There's also great consternation and fear, especially on the part of my daughter. She's a Parkinson's patient and has ongoing pain issues along with everything else that goes with Parkinson's. What I think I'm seeing is a very mixed picture at this point. I was just briefly overhearing a few of the call-ins from your previous segment, and the lady who is facing such personal agony at this point, I think, is probably fairly representative. I work in social media just about every day, and for me that means Facebook and a few other places. And in that environment, what I see is reports of people dying of suicide every week. I see reports of people who have gone through surgery and been denied any kind of opioid in favor of Tylenol. And I'm not exaggerating here. What we have is a picture in which suicides, I believe, although I don't believe CDC is collecting the statistics, the suicides due to denial of pain relief are at least in the hundreds in the last year. And I mean at least. It's very hard to know what the topside number is. I've talked myself, personally, person to person, with two people whose husbands suicided because they were discharged by doctors who didn't refer them and wouldn't refer them, or who referred them just to resources that would not, in fact, entertain them as patients. I've talked with patients who have basically made plans to suicide because they don't see any way out. And contrasted against that, as your last interviewer indicated, CDC is maintaining a vast silence on the need to retract and withdraw the guidelines of 2016 for a major rewrite, which it absolutely needs. I mean, the guidelines are, I would say, unsafe at any speed, if you want to take
Let me ask you this. What do you think the motive for CDC was in this? They had to know what the effect of this would be. They've seen it, the backlash across the country and the terrible agony it's caused. What was going on there?
I think, and this is one of those places where I want to be careful not to sound like a conspiracy theorist.
You're in the right place. No, you're in the right place. Go ahead.
Well, okay. I think what actually happened there was that the CDC standards themselves were unduly influenced by people who, for their own reasons, and sometimes those reasons amount to financial gain, were very strongly anti-opioid with the agenda that they brought to the discussions of the core group that did all the writing. In fact, the whole process the CDC used was invalid. They violated their own standards of research when they did the literature searches to address the questions of just, you know, what are the risks and the benefits of opioids. And they got caught at it. They did research which literally doesn't stand up to any reasonable scrutiny. And I think it was Princeton, as a matter of fact, published a rather scathing review, and there have been a number of other scathing reviews of what actually happened in the CDC process. One organization I believe you've had mentioned earlier in the show was the Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescription. And those folks basically seem to have tried to create a star chamber proceeding, just literally an unregulated, let's see what we can do to destroy opioids discussion. And they did it by distorting the available information and cherry-picking the available information. One of the articles that I found really illuminating on this is titled Neat, Plausible, and Generally Wrong, a comment on the CDC opioid standards. And it was by three practicing physicians who went back in and looked at all the research and basically concluded that the core group, perhaps deliberately, and it's not absolutely clear why that is, but the core group basically distorted the record of science on a lot of the issues that pertained.
You wrote an article called Figures Lie and Liars Figure about why the demographics of the so-called opioid crisis don't work, about who's dying, which we've discussed a couple of times earlier in the program. You look at, you know, it's not pain patients who are dying so much. Some of them are, but the overwhelming majority are dying of fentanyl overdoses, heroin overdoses. I mean, the fentanyl, you can go online and buy it from China, get it shipped in discreetly. You can buy a pill press online and make your own pills. The Mexican cartels, drug cartels are doing exactly that right now. People take these pills and they die. And you know when it hits town because five or six people will die. The heroin supply is strong, plentiful, cheap, powerful. After 15 years of the U.S. being in Afghanistan, the world's flooded with heroin. I'm open to the idea of conspiracies because, I mean, this crackdown on pain patients doesn't solve a problem. It just makes agony for pain patients.
Yeah, I would want to point out something to people who proclaim themselves to be authorities on this. The other part of the title of that article you're mentioning is why the demographics of the so-called prescription opioid crisis don't work, and they don't work. And an organization like the CDC should know that they don't work. And let's be clear on that. Demographics is really the study of populations. It says, you know, who does what, who is affected by what issues. And when you look at who chronic pain patients are and who addicts are, the numbers don't match. This is really important now, and I want to credit a lady by the name of Maya Zalovitz, who first published an article that got my attention in Scientific American on this. As she pointed out, the National Institutes for Drug Abuse, or on drug abuse, have characterized who beginning addicts really are. They tend to be, in a rather large majority of cases, young white males who have a history of family trauma, which is often economically based. I mean, you're talking about people who come out of the Rust Belt in many cases, not all, who have some comorbid history of mental health issues very often. And yeah, they may wind up getting addicted, but they do to polydrug doses that they get in the street. And when prescription pills are involved in that, in over three quarters of the cases, the people who are first using are using pills that were never prescribed for them. Moreover, young white males are underserved medically. They very rarely are seen for pain conditions that would justify the prescription of an opioid for more than just a few days. And probably the most common condition is dental surgery. Now then, let's look at the other side of this picture and say who are chronic pain patients? And we know quite a lot about that too. The typical chronic pain patient is a woman in her 40s or older who has a problem with a failed back syndrome or fibromyalgia or complex regional pain syndrome, and who is, frankly, a very low risk for addiction under any circumstances. So when you look at the people who are beginning as addicts and the people who are chronic pain patients, there's only a small overlap. There's no way that pain pills could account for this so-called hyped epidemic. I think, as a matter of fact, your previous interviewer, Josh Bloom, may have remarked that when you look at numbers like 60,000, which is all drug-related deaths, whether an opioid is involved or not, and you boil the numbers down, it may wind up being, even though it's a tragedy for the people that are involved, it may be that out of 60,000, maybe 6 to 10,000 actually have had an opioid prescription and have died as a result of either mixing it with something else, very often anti-anxiety pills, or taking alcohol with it. And you know, you got a hyped epidemic that really isn't an epidemic and never was. And the people who are hyping these figures all too often have an interest in seeing a reduction of the costs of insurance companies. And that one is a really troubling statistic when you get down to it. So,
I mean, yeah, it boils down to who benefits.
Liars figure and figures lie. Right. It's because they do, and they are. And the CDC has not come to terms with that. They have not commented at all on the conflicts in these numbers. And they need to.
Well, I agree with Absolutely. You. I have other questions, but we've had some people hanging on the phones for a long time. First-time caller Rose in Seattle. In Washington State, there's a lot of pain patients have problems up there. Hi, Rose.
Hi there. Yeah, I wanted to correct one thing that one of the previous speakers mentioned. It's true that Washington State passed restrictions about opioid prescribing at 120 morphine equivalent units back in 2009, but the state legislature passed a new bill this year, and they're currently in the progress of lowering that restriction, that limit, down to max. This faulty CDC guidelines to 90 milligrams. So we're at further risk here in Washington State of an even more restrictive policy that is already negatively affecting pain patients everywhere, like myself. And what the result of that is it's driving doctors out of prescribing opioids for any reason, including, I heard this week, somebody who had a pretty invasive surgery at one of our major hospitals, and rather than prescribe pain medication, they gave her an epidural to manage her pain, which dislodged in the night, and she was in agony because they were afraid of treating a surgical patient with pain medication. And the result is that people who suffer from chronic pain, who have been stable on their dosage of pain medication for years and years, are left with three choices. One, we die from cardiac events or serious stress from untreated pain. Two, it drives otherwise law-abiding people out to the street to find unsafe and lethal street drugs to treat their pain in desperation. Or three, they commit suicide because they're just in unbearable agony every day and they cannot take the pain, which, as Mr. Lahern already alluded to, is happening more and more frequently because people just aren't meant to handle this level of agony every single day. And in some cases, it's bad every day, but then flares worse than some days more than others. So it's just, you're absolutely correct. Your whole program here of this whole epidemic has been hyped out of a very small percentage of tragic overdose deaths that are impacting 100 million Americans, hardworking, tax-paying citizens, who've done nothing wrong, who are not addicts, who've never abused their prescription medications, and yet here we are suffering.
Rose, I know that in Washington, I remember reading that when the crackdown began before the CDC, that your state sent pain patients to methadone. I guess a lot of people ended up dying on methadone.
That's
Brad, are you
correct.
Yeah.
I am.
Go ahead.
The Seattle Times actually did a piece that won the Pulitzer Prize on this, actually, because the state of Washington had, for their super low-income residents, they had the state health insurance for low-income people, and they mandated the formulary that for pain, they only would use methadone because it's far cheaper than any of the other drugs. But it's far more deadly because it metabolizes so inconsistently compared to other drugs. So many other states won't use it for that reason. But my state, because it wanted to save money, all because of the actions of one gentleman who's the director of our labor and industries, he was quoted as saying, well, sure, people are dying, but long-term use of opioids are always problematic. But when he was pressed to say, yeah, but methadone is killing more of our poor residents than any other drug and in higher numbers, and we have the data to prove it, he had no good answer. So the Seattle Times did a great piece, I believe it was in 2011, that you can find if you just search for Seattle
right.
Times methadone, because
right.
when you win the Pulitzer, you talk about it. And
Rose, let me get Red in here to comment. I guess, Red, that the story that Rose is telling us from Washington is something that sounds familiar to you.
Oh, it sounds very familiar. I believe right now the number of states that one way or another are imposing opioid limits is up above 18. Maine is one of the worst. I'm hearing a lot from that side, too. You know, there's another interesting stat that's a part of the same picture here. You know, we keep hearing about a prescription opioid crisis. There isn't any. When the state of Massachusetts tried to do a trace between people who had died in overdose and their state prescription database, this was published in the Boston Globe, I think in December of 2015, they found that only 8% of people who died of an overdose actually had a current prescription. And that's out of, you know, over 1,000 people. That's a figure of which, if it was duplicated in other states, I can just about guarantee you, you'd see the same picture. Now, Washington is particularly a problem because they're trying to become the first state that outright outlaws opioids. And there just is no medical excuse. There's no medical reason for forcing someone to taper down from a medication on which they have been stable and are functioning at a higher quality of life than they could possibly have without it. But that's happening all over America.
Well, I'm wondering what, you know, this is bigger than just chronic pain patients. When you have Washington state outlawing opioids, the total use, what happens to surgery patients? They're not chronic pain patients. You should go in for surgery. What do you do for pain?
Well, a lot of them are going to become chronic pain patients as a consequence of being denied medication for a condition that will become progressive. Because people who are denied appropriate treatment after surgery may develop other pain-related disorders. And Rose mentioned cardiac arrest. That is a substantially higher risk after surgery when pain is not appropriately treated. We're going to see stats on that soon. You know, there's another article that I think is extremely helpful in this regard. It was published by the Stat News Group, which is, again, an organ of the Boston Globe. And the title of the article is, "A Civil War Over Painkillers Rips Apart the Medical Community and Puts Patients in Fear." It was published in January of this year, and Stat News has left the comments open ever since. And there are hundreds of reports from patients who have been forced off of medications that used to work for them. There are hundreds of reports from patients who have had a family member severely disabled because of a refusal to prescribe opioids for chronic pain.
We're talking about chronic pain issues with Red Lawhern, and John Lennon takes us into the break. We'll be back with more from Red, and well as your calls and comments in our final segment of Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about chronic pain patients, the plight they find themselves in, millions of them affected by the CDC supposedly voluntary guidelines that have been enacted into law by states all across the country, forced tapering, some millions of people cut off from opioids medications altogether, others just cut in half or by two-thirds. It's had drastic effects on people's lives. I think I've heard from something like 2,000 emails and letters since we started working on these stories, and the reports from chronic pain patients across the board are pretty much the same. People living in agony and fear, some of them not living at all. They've taken their own lives. It's drastic, and you have to wonder, is there anything that people can do, that chronic pain patients and their families, that people who care about them can do? I'm going to ask my guest, Dr. Red Lawhern, about that, ideas for organizing or lawsuits or whatever it might take, in our final segment of Coast to Coast AM. Red Lawhern, we posted a link on the Coast to Coast website for something called the FDA's Opioid Policy Steering Committee, and are told that they are inviting public comment and opinion. Do you happen to know whether that's a worthwhile exercise for chronic pain patients? Is it worth their time?
It certainly is. It's not the only one. It turns out that the Department of Health and Human Services is assembling an interagency task force on best practice in pain management. They've solicited input and people have been nominated. I haven't heard who has actually been confirmed on that group, but they will meet periodically to try to reconsider the issues on pain management. The Opioid Steering Committee, however, is basically an interior group, and by that's to say it's a government group. You can make input to it, but if we have the same thing occur that has happened with the guidelines themselves during 2016-2015, the impact of comments made by the public will be zero. If the fix is already in, the steering committee will probably ignore most of the input, because that's what CDC did when they got 4,000 comments on the guidelines. Now, that being said, a lot of this could stop tomorrow with the right action. And it is very important, and the organization that I've been building for the last year is involved in this very deeply. Petitions are not going to do it. Letter writing is not going to do it. Congressmen are set up these days, congressmen and congresswomen in some cases, are set up to ignore the input of the public because their corporate donors don't want certain things to happen. And there's been an awful lot of buying congressmen through campaign contributions, frankly. But there's one thing they can't ignore, and that's somebody who comes into their office and says, "You're killing me." And that's a face-to-face interview. And what ATIP, the group that I'm working with, the Alliance for the Treatment of Intractable Pain, what we're doing is developing information and training for people to contact their own legislators or to contact the healthcare legislative assistants of their legislators for in-person interviews in state and Washington district offices, to go in and basically say, "Guys, you got it wrong, and there's only one way you can get it right, and that is to write a letter or co-sign a letter among your colleagues to the director of the CDC, and you tell that individual, you're not going to get another dime of funding until you make a public commitment to withdraw these guidelines and rewrite them from the ground up with patient representatives in the voting group that does the writing." And it has to be done professionally and thoughtfully and with courtesy, but in-person appointments with people who represent the human face of pain may be the last resort of people who are being damaged by these guidelines. If I may add one other footnote.
Sure.
You've remarked on the supposedly voluntary nature of the guidelines, and they
right.
aren't. They are not voluntary, and the CDC knew that they would not be for all veterans when they published them, because an act of Congress during budget resolution in December of 2015 made the guidelines mandatory for Veterans Affairs, for the Department of Veterans Health Affairs. And the CDC knew it when they published, and the Department of Veteran Affairs is regularly denying pain relief and pain medication to patients who suicide, and they know they are suiciding. it's coming
Yeah,
up
these
in
guys are
numbers
they're
that
coming
can't
back
be
from
ignored.
they're coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, or maybe they've served in an earlier served with honor in earlier conflicts. The government's supposedly promised to take care of them, and they're cutting them off.
Exactly. And they're cutting them off by policy, as a matter of fact. I believe the policy may even be published. There's a report out even now, which I believe the National Pain Report published, that indicates that the GAO is calling for even more restrictions on opioids in all of government policy that's related to this. So what I'm going after, and others who have joined ATIP as medical professionals and knowledgeable patients are going after, we're trying to help people get geared up with information that is solid and can be traced to creditable sources, to go and talk with their people in government, either state or local, to accomplish two objectives. One is to demand the immediate withdrawal of the CDC guidelines for a rewrite to correct their many errors, and above all, to correct the error that doesn't reflect the fact that there can never ever be a single standard of opioid prescription, because human beings don't operate that way.
One
There are
size
millions
does
of
not
people
fit
in the
all,
U.S.
right?
So there are millions of people in the U.S. who are either hypermetabolizers or poor metabolizers of opioids. And that's published data. That's science. It's not a surmise. But you put those people on 100 mmED per day dose, and opioid therapy will fail for them. I have talked to patients who are stable and functional on doses that are 25 times the level declared in the CDC standard as a threshold of risk. And people who know the science behind this ought to realize that the guidelines can't be phrased that way. They just can't. So the second objective we have, and this is one that's going to take a lot of digging to make happen, is that we want patients and family members to lobby state legislators to repeal regulations like that in Maine, and the ones that the guys in Washington are trying to bring about, that restrict the use of opioids and impose the government into the doctor-patient relationship. The government has no business being in that relationship. It has no skill to be in that relationship. So if anybody wants to find us, you can look up the term Alliance for the Treatment of Intractable Pain,
We've got the link on our website, Red. We've got the link, and people can find you just by going to Coast to Coast, or they can look for ATIP. We got a bunch of people on the phones that have been holding for a long time, so I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I know that they wanted to get their two cents in. On the
go right
wildcard
ahead.
line, Laura is calling from Southern California. Hey, Laura.
How are you today?
Okay, what's on your mind?
Well, I am a doctor, and I've been a physician in both rural practice for Medicare, TRICARE, as well as the underserved. And unfortunately, that hysteria that doctors feel, I'm unfortunately a victim of it. And I followed all the rules with pain contracts, tox screen, seeing my patients every month, and making sure that had adequate medication. And I am still a victim as a physician of the CDC guidelines. And the CDC guidelines came out within a few months, and that's when I started being investigated. And the culprit, which is the corporate slug, would be the CVS themselves and the pharmacists who started this original war on drugs. CVS pharmacists work in conjunction with the medical board and the DEA to turn in patients and doctors. That is what is happening. And the targeting, what happened is, in my situation, allegations were filed. My patients are on more medications because of the hypermetabolizers, et cetera. I was only following about 30 patients. My office was not a film mill. I did not make any extra money. They were my HMO patients, regular primary care, as well as TRICARE veterans who were seeking relief from pain. And just as your callers have communicated. These patients, they wake up with pain, they go to sleep with pain, they can't get the pain off of them. And it makes them miserable. They lose their marriages, their houses, their jobs, their families. And the pharmacists, what they do, and the pharmacies, they label the patients as drug-seeking. And they label the doctors as being investigated. And this starts along the pattern of soliciting complaints against doctors and starts this process, of which I am unfortunately under right now. And my doctor friends who are pain doctors, who actually, he just ended up in the hospital for 2 weeks. He has he got a DVT and blood clots in his lungs. He's been so stressed out in his own personal practice of trying to follow the guidelines, and not, he did in the past get in trouble once. It cost him $100,000 in lawyer fees to get a public reprimand. And he's done what your callers have said, what pain doctors, they don't prescribe, they do injections. They're not wanting to even see the patients because of the attacks on their medical license by the medical board. So this is really happening in America. And what I'm glad, George, is that you're bringing this out so other doctors will be able to share their stories, because they're afraid. You lose your IPA contracts, you lose all your patients, you lose your ability to be a physician. And I've actually had to go back to my old job when I was in college, which is to serve tables and be a waitress while I'm waiting to go before the administrative board. So this is really happening. This is really happening in America. And I'm a doctor, Boston trained, 25 years, fellowship trained, with a master's of public health. I've been on national boards, state boards. I've been active at different levels, and I'm actually published as well, because I'm a past faculty member in a university.
Makes you wonder, could they do the same with other medications? You know, we don't want to pay for it anymore, so we're just going to declare it illegal, and doctors can't prescribe it anymore.
George, may I amplify on that?
Sure.
The foremost pain management physician in America is now under attack by the same idiots in the DEA, and for the same reasons, because he insists on treating pain. His name is Forrest Tennant. And this process is happening all over America, and it is happening by means that I regard as extrajudicial. Now, this is a personal opinion. The DEA is deliberately seeking to drive doctors out of pain management practice if they insist on using opioids. And they're doing it by means that are, frankly, illegal. They are suborning witnesses. They are prominently announcing their investigations in order to destroy the reputations of the doctors that they intend to challenge. They are prolonging judicial proceedings, trying to drive doctors into consent decrees. They have literally conducted a McCarthyite war on doctors. And frankly, if I was to put a label on the branch of the DEA that does this nonsense, I would say they ought to be prosecuted under the Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act. It is that apparent that what they're doing is literally illegal. And yet they haven't been brought to heel, and they won't be until somebody says stop to the DEA from Congress. That's another thing worth trying to do. And I completely empathize with your last physician who has just called in, because I've heard her story from several other doctors who are equally being challenged. One of the things that's horrifying in this situation is that the people who are doing the so-called diversion investigations, they aren't trained in medicine. They aren't trained to discriminate between patterns of prescription that could be a pill mill versus patterns of prescription that represent normal practice for the most severely affected patients. They have no idea of what is actually involved in a doctor's practice, except they go looking for things that they call red flags. And the red flags basically amount to large doses of opioids for people who need them. And frankly, I think the whole operation is rotten to the core. I'm not gonna pull punches on that. I think it's time for Congress to say, hold it. DEA, you're no longer authorized to confiscate the assets of a doctor that you're investigating. You're no longer authorized to offer plea deals to people who have lied to that doctor about their other opioid involvements in order to get testimony that you that you are basically requiring that they perjure themselves to deliver. This is ridiculous.
Well, I'll tell you, I've over the years worked with a lot of DEA agents here in Nevada, and you know, they put their lives on the line taking on these cartels and smugglers and things of that sort. And I would be very reluctant to paint them all with that brush. I don't understand why they went after Dr. Tennant, and I don't understand why, with an illicit fentanyl problem that's growing by the day, that they would focus on such a small target. But I understand your frustrations. I'm going to try to get one more call in. Mike in Illinois has been hanging on for a long time and wanted to tell us that he had to turn to the black market. Is that right?
Yes, it is. I've had ulcerative colitis when I was young and affected my joints. And I'm 69. I've had severe joint pain for 30 years. And a lot of my life, I just went without it. But now I've gotten older and I need it and I can't get it from my doctor. And they turn me into a criminal because he will not give me the medication I need. I have to go out and buy it on the street, and I just take what they would give me. I don't take over. I just follow my own, you know, I know what they would give me. But instead, it costs me $500 a month instead of $5 a month, and it's just killing me financially.
So you're buying pain pills, prescription pain pills?
Yes. There's plenty out there to buy, but they're so expensive that, you know, it's just, I got to pay $5 bill.
Mike, thank you for calling. I'm sure, sorry we're out of time. I want to give Red the last minute here. Red, I'm looking for a ray of hope, and the suggestions that you have made about organizing are certainly as promising as anything I've heard tonight. So.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's even within the general range of the recommendations made by the Christie Commission, because they have suggested that the guidelines of the CDC be refined, even though they did it on the wrong basis. Lobbying our legislators is something that pain patients themselves may have a really hard time doing, because many of them are not very mobile. But everybody has a family member. Everybody has somebody in their life that can learn what's going on and learn the realities behind the issues of pain patients and addiction, and make an appointment with their legislator or with the commissions in various places in various states.
All right, Dr. Richard Lawhern, thanks very much. Appreciate it. Again, we've got links to your organization, ATIP, on the Coast to Coast website. Want to say thanks to my earlier guests, Dr. Lynn Webster, Dr. Josh Bloom, Barbie Engel, Dr. Steven Ziegler, and Joe, the anonymous pharmacist. And thanks to my colleagues there at Coast, Nathan Staten, Donna Walker, Dan Galati, our webmaster tonight, Lex Lonehood, and our producer, Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. Good night, everyone.